because the word Rich would want to give you, that workers, we are never, ever, ever going to back down.
Arlene Holt-Baker, Executive Vice President for the AFL-CIO from 2009 to 2013. She was the first African-American to ever serve as an executive officer in the AFL-CIO's history. And I want to thank Jose La Luz, veteran labor organizer, campaigner, and educator. Coming up, we go to Afghanistan, where the U.S. is ramping up airstrikes as the Taliban tries to seize a number of provincial capitals. Stay with us.
The sun comes up about 10 in the morning, and the sun goes down about 3 in the day. Fill your cup with whatever bitter brew you're drinking, and you spend your life just thinking about how to get away. No one calling them mountains till a man from the northeast arrived. He waved them $100 bills, said I'll pay you.
This is KBOO Portland, and unfortunately we're not going to be able to air the final segment of Democracy Now! This morning. We will be rebroadcasting the entire program as usual at 4 p.m. And also, the whole program is available online for folks for folks with internet access. You can check out the program at democracynow.org. Thank you so much for tuning in this morning. Coming up next is The Gap. Mind the gap, because we're going to bridge it, because girls are powerful. Stay tuned.
Good morning, and thank you all for tuning in to KBOO Portland. This is The Gap. We're reminding, we're bridging, we're fixing, and all of the adjectives and adverbs. On the line with me today is the magnificent Althea. How are you, Althea?
Well, calling in from outside the Portland area, but as always, very glad to be here. Very glad we made it to August. Look at us.
We did it. I remember last August, things were a little different. So yeah, it's nice to be here halfway in person, but you know, it is what it is, as we say on the show. Appreciate you being with us.
You did say that here.
Connecting with us on the airwaves. And of course, Sonia Terrestrial Angel is holding it down and getting our guests for the first segment on and connected. And for our first part, we are going to be speaking with some folks, an organizer with the Still in Prison campaign, and a community member who decided to help out the campaign. And we're going to hear about the Still in Prison campaign, as well as the community reaction and organizing that is happening around it. We will have our first guest is going to be Greg McElvey, who is a local, both of them local, and he is the organizer with the Still in Prison campaign, which is aiming to discuss and bring to the forefront the awareness around ununanimous juries and its effect that it has on people historically in the country, specifically in Oregon, and what it means now, since there is a bit of a closing of circle. We'll be talking about the August 12th event that is being put on to raise awareness around the Still in Prison campaign and different action items that you, the listener and community member, can take in order to, you know, make a difference. And I think on the line we actually have Greg and Greg with us. Is that right? Hi, Greg. How are you doing?
Yeah.
We also have Ben Anderson Nathy, who is a member of the Jewish community, who is supporting the Still in Prison campaign, because there is also a lot of different connections, and we're going to get to that right now. How are you, Ben and Greg? Gregory, excuse me.
No, you're good. Thank you so much for having us on.
Definitely. Well, Gregory, could you give us a little bit of history about non-unanimous juries here in the U.S. and then specifically how it relates to Oregon?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So non-unanimous juries, I mean, we've all seen probably jury movies where like 12 angry men in the past are supposed to come into a jury box and unanimously come to a decision, and if they can't, it's a hung jury, and the state can either decide to try the case again or not, or the person is found not guilty. And that's what we're sort of used to in the United States as the system, but there were two states, Louisiana first and then Oregon, that allowed for non-unanimous juries, meaning that somebody could be convicted even if one or two people on the jury thought that the person was not guilty. And this was done at first in Louisiana following Reconstruction. We obviously all know about the Jim Crow laws that happened after Reconstruction, and this was another effort to diminish the Black voices. And they literally said when they at their constitutional convention, when they passed non-unanimous juries, that it was, quote, to establish the supremacy of the white race and to ensure that African-American juror service would be meaningless. So the notion was that they thought that if there were Black people on a jury, that they would either not understand the jury system and were incapable of doing so, or they would just let people off who were Black individuals accused of a crime. And so it really has its roots in racism in Louisiana. Not too long after, around 1934, during basically a rising tide of racism, anti-Semitism, and xenophobia, which was really pushed by the KKK in Oregon and following a really high-profile case involving the Jewish community, Oregon joined Louisiana as the only other state to allow for non-unanimous juries. So in that time, there's, you know, potentially thousands of people that have been convicted of non-unanimous juries specifically to silence the voices of minorities, and that has disproportionately ended up impacting people who are non-white who have been accused of crimes. And that existed on the books for a long time in Oregon, and Oregon and Louisiana were the only states to allow it until the Supreme Court eventually struck down non-unanimous juries. And it's interesting because we actually had justices like Brett Kavanaugh basically call Oregon racist. He said that the rule in question here is rooted in racism and in a desire to diminish the voices of Black jurors. And it's interesting to have somebody like Brett Kavanaugh call our state racist. Justice Ginsburg said the words jury trial themselves mean a non-unanimous verdict, and they struck it down. So Oregon was unable to continue the practice of non-unanimous juries. That's what we call the Ramos decision. And after this decision, the question really on the table was, what do we do for the people who had already been convicted of non-unanimous juries, because it was not retroactive? The Attorney General of Oregon has fought against people who have asked for relief based on the unconstitutionality of non-unanimous juries, but yet and thus no one has been given a new trial who has been still in prison, and that's where the name Still in Prison comes from. And recently we had a Supreme Court ruling that basically said this is in the state's hands when it comes to retroactivity, and so it's up to the states to decide what they do for people who were already still in prison, which firmly put the ball into the court of the Attorney General. But instead of just doing what she could do instantly with basically the stroke of a pen, she has now asked the legislature to step in and and also the Oregon Supreme Court to hopefully solve this issue. And so now we're looking at a push for legislation that would allow for anybody who has been convicted of a non-unanimous jury who can prove that they've been convicted of a non-unanimous jury and who wants a new trial to be afforded a new trial that's untainted of this specific form of racism.
Wow, yeah. Well, Gregory, thank you both so much for being here. I want to hit on one specific point. You talked a little bit about what distinguishes non-unanimous juries from unanimous juries. What does that imply about the standard of proof? How much proof was there for folks who were convicted under a non-unanimous jury?
It just makes it easier to convict people in general. And it as with all things that are discriminatory, has disproportionately impacted the Black community, but there certainly are many white folks or white appearing folks that have also been convicted who otherwise in no other state other than Oregon or Louisiana would have been convicted. So it skyrockets our convictions. And yes, as you point out, the burden of proof, it's supposed to be beyond a reasonable doubt. And I would say that if there are two people on the jury who say that this person is not guilty, that that's probably not beyond a reasonable doubt.
And so thank you so much for mentioning that. But for the, I guess for the scale of convictions that were under non-unanimous juries, let's say they were proved, that it was non-unanimous and that's how the conviction came about. What is the concern about that the AG has about overwhelming the courts, or is it something about the legitimacy, or what is exactly the concern that the AG has in your opinion?
Well, I think at the root of a lot of people's hesitation to address non-unanimous juries, I think everybody has basically stipulated to the fact that this is racist. I mean, spanning the gambit here from Brett Kavanaugh to the late Justice Ginsburg, and even our attorney general has noted that this is racist. But I think, I'm speculating here, but I think at the root of some of the hesitancy to address it is people think that these people are still guilty. Even if it was 10 to 2, that most of them probably did it. And that's just not the point. We are supposed to have a legal system that is untainted of white supremacy and laws that were specifically pushed by the KKK. And it is very likely that some people who are given new trials, they might end up being convicted again. But our point is more about process, and if the process was racist, that they should be entitled to a new process. When it comes to overwhelming the courts, which is outwardly what most people would say is a reason why we haven't addressed this issue, it's just simply not true. One, our courts have been have withstood a pandemic and still been able to efficiently lock up people, disproportionately Black people, in all parts of our country. And also, we're not talking, and I think this is an important point, we're not talking tens of thousands of people here for different reasons. One, it's hard to prove that you had a non-unanimous jury, and I would credit Aliza Kaplan from Lewis and Clark Law School, who has done a lot of the work on identifying who has been given who was convicted via non-unanimous jury. But we're talking probably about certainly less than 1,000 cases spread out across Oregon. Obviously, because Multnomah County is the most populous, it would have the most cases, but we are still processing people in Multnomah County courts for the most minor of protest charges. So the notion that we suddenly care about overwhelming the courts now, when we have been disproportionately putting Black people, houseless people, and others in jail or through our court system because of victimless crimes is basically ludicrous. And also we're in a state now that has decriminalized many drugs, and I would argue that that might free up some space in the courts for them to handle these trials. Now, a murder trial, or a or other serious felonies do take longer and are more serious cases and take more attention from the district attorney than minor cases. But what I would just center the people who are sitting still in prison, who are either innocent or who have been convicted via a racist law. And, you know, I can't go to them and say, sorry, you're going to have to stay in prison because it's inconvenient for the courts. That's just simply not good enough and not how our justice system should function.
Right. If it's wrong, it's still wrong, even if it, you know, is a minor inconvenience to the court. So how does the campaign address getting folks out of prison who were convicted by a non-unanimous jury? What is the remedy that the campaign is looking for?
Yeah, I mean, it's a simple that anyone who is convicted, who can show that they were convicted via a non-unanimous jury, should be afforded a new trial if they so choose. And the reason why we say if they so choose as opposed to if it being automatic is because some of these people have already served their time and are out and just simply don't want to be thrown back into the system and relitigate a case that they've already served their time for. And so we wouldn't want to, and also there's a concern about throwing victims back, alleged victims back into the court system as well and making them rehash potential crimes. So for some people, they just want to be done with the court system. They've found a way to live even with their convictions outside of jail. And so we don't want to force anybody back into the court system that doesn't want to be thrown back into a court system that is still largely racist regardless of this law. So, yeah, the ask is just that anybody who wants a new trial who is convicted of a non-unanimous jury should be afforded a new trial. And it's, and you know, some people have accused us of just simply saying open the gates, right? And I'm sure there are many people involved in the campaign who would love for that to be the case, but the ask really is that they be awarded a new trial. And it's certainly possible that for some of these cases, the district attorney reviews the case and says, sorry, I can't prove this case with a unanimous jury, and doesn't try the case, and there's concerns about evidence and how long they're arrested, if they've kept the evidence, et cetera. But again, you know, I can't go back to people that are still in prison and tell them, sorry, it's too inconvenient, or the state lost the evidence, so you're just going to have to sit here.
Yeah, definitely. The impact is really outstanding. For so many people, and that had to deal with an already, you know, racist system, but then on top of it to just be blatantly, discriminatory. I wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk about the impact of the coalition and how far it's gotten so far, because the Attorney General has changed their minds a couple of times because of the pressure applied by the coalition. So can you speak on that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, it's thanks to people like Ben and others who have helped out the coalition that I think we're in this spot now, with the Attorney General even asking for the legislature to be acting on this issue. Many people are probably hearing about this issue even as they listen for the first time, but it's this huge atrocity that has not been a focus in our state. And we have talked a lot as a state about our racist past, whether that's exclusion laws and the KKK's presence in Oregon, but we haven't talked a lot about specific ways we can rectify some of those wrongs. This is one of those specific ways, and I think that there's just been so much media attention, there's been so much work done in the courts from the Ramos Project and Professor Aliza Kaplan, and then there's been so much just grassroots advocacy of people in the coalition getting the word out. I mean, we have such a broad coalition that's growing every single day of dozens of groups, and each of them have their own email lists, their own pressure abilities to pressure their communities and the people that they represent, and I think that has simply been working.
Definitely. Thank you so much for that. And so right now there is an event, next week there is an event that is happening that is a teach-in, but also is going to have some folks speaking. I was wondering if either you or Ben would like to talk about the event that's happening on August 12th so listeners can be informed and, you know, learn more about the Still in Prison coalition and campaign.
Sure, I can pick that up. We have there's a group of organizations in the Jewish community here in Oregon, including Havarah Shalom, Congregation Shir Tikva, Bend the Arc Jewish Action, the Alberta Shul, Never Again Action Portland, and Tish PDX, who have come together to sponsor a teach-in on the 12th, next Thursday at 12 o'clock, and there will be information available to listeners on the Still in Prison website about the teach-in. The teach-in will sponsor or will feature Dr. Lisa Kaplan, whom Gregory already mentioned, is a professor at Lewis and Clark Law School and the director of the Criminal Justice Reform Clinic, and Terrence Hayes with Liberation Literacy, and who is a member of the Oregon DA for the People. And was convicted under a non-unanimous jury. We'll be speaking about sort of the history and longstanding, 86 plus year legacy of this law in Oregon, specifically sort of reaching out to Oregon's Jewish community that, there's in Oregon, as Gregory said, the non-unanimous jury decision in 1934 came about directly as a result of explicitly anti-Semitic and xenophobic attitudes and rhetoric pushed largely by the Klan. And while the anti-Semitic component and the xenophobic components of sort of the legacy of this law have shifted somewhat, it's important for us to bear in mind that xenophobia, anti-Semitism, and racism function hand in hand with one another and impact many people in the same communities in compounding and complicated ways. We also believe, as organizers working in solidarity with Still in Prison, that the Jewish community has a specific value stance and a specific obligation to respond to the Attorney General and to push the Attorney General to make the decisions that are in their power to make, right? To either just decide, which is still a possibility, to stipulate to retroactivity at this point, or, as Gregory was saying, to push for legislative action. There's a really clear value stance around righting the wrongs of the world when we become aware of them, taking accountability for our part in those wrongdoings, and making what in Hebrew we call teshuva, the act of returning, sort of coming back. This is an opportunity for us as a state to come back, and we want to push the Attorney General to do that. So in addition to the teach-in, we will be also inviting participants in that teach-in to sign on to a letter from members of the Oregon Jewish community directly to the AG, requesting action that is congruent with the best values of justice and teshuvah in Jewish tradition. And again, that letter will also be hosted on the Still in Prison website.
Thank you for that. And can you talk about, you are not part of the Still in Prison coalition, but you are a community member who wanted to support this, the efforts and the campaign. So can you talk about what made you want to provide this support, and if you think it's important that it specifically comes from your community, considering that the AG is part of it?
Sure. I think that for many of us who started working on this project, one, I should mention that as a mini collective, we're still very new to this issue, to be honest. I think that's exciting and an opportunity for listeners who may be learning, as Gregory said, maybe learning about non-unanimous juries for the very first time. I want to say it's not too late, and one doesn't have to have been connected to this work for decades in order to still participate in amplifying the work of the coalition and pushing for change in these issues. this group of Jews in the largely in the Portland metro area really just came together starting last winter. Had become aware of non-unanimous juries and the Ramos decision, and were also aware that the question of retroactivity was before the Supreme Court, and the Attorney General, both here and in Louisiana, had the power to act, but were waiting on that action to hear from the Supreme Court. And when the Supreme Court made its decision related to retroactivity, that they were not going to say that Ramos is automatically retroactive and push that back to the states, we realized that we really had an opportunity to push the Attorney General. And when you have an Attorney General who goes on the record in 2020 and says that the practice of non-unanimous juries is an embarrassment to our otherwise progressive state, right? When someone is explicitly naming the embarrassment and injustice of a policy or a practice, and yet not acting when they have the authority and power to act, it's quite difficult to just sort of sit back and be silent and throw one's hands up and say, well, that's okay. You know, sometimes I think it's important for folks inside the family to say to our family members, you know, something you're doing stinks right now, and it's time for us to clean that up. And so I think what drew me into this this work and the support and solidarity to Still in Prison was really the idea that there are many different lanes. There are lots of, you know, in most activism or organizing, there are lots of different ways that lots of different roads that people can take on the same issue while working together in solidarity. And when we spoke with Gregory and others at Still in Prison, it became clear that one path that hadn't yet been fully explored was sort of pursuing this angle of Jewish values and Jewish social ethics. And so it seemed like a really sort of ideal opportunity for us to be able to chime in and hopefully apply some pressure.
Yeah, thank you for
that.
Thank
you for that, Ben. Yeah, I want to ask a question of Gregory. So Ben mentioned that it's within the Attorney General's discretion to make this retroactive. So I want to ask about, you know, is that something that the AG has used before, that kind of, like, as I think you mentioned, the signing of the pen, and what has impacted her kind of tune changing instead of saying, you know, I'm not going to do this, I don't think that it's, like, within my purview, to I will potentially help push this through as a legislative action or at the state Supreme Court level?
Right. Yeah, certainly the Attorney General and all prosecutors use discretion every single day. I mean, our entire law enforcement and how we prosecute and how we arrest people is full of discretion. You can tell by the people who jaywalk and don't get arrested because police use discretion. Spitting in public is still illegal in Portland. I doubt many people are being arrested for spitting in public. Discretion is used within our judicial system and law enforcement all the time, and our Attorney General used discretion and fought really hard, and I think rightfully, for marriage equality, but now is unwilling to do the same when it comes to when it comes to racism. So the other thing is, we elect this person. They're supposed to represent the people. This is somebody who might be running for higher office as well. And if we were going to elect somebody who wasn't able to use their judgment on behalf of the people that elected them, then we might as well just have a bureaucrat in that position, as opposed to a politician. The whole point of electing somebody is that they're going to make decisions on behalf of and for the people that they represent. When it comes to her pushing now, I mean, it's better than doing nothing. But it still is sort of passing the buck. And, you know, we've sort of accepted that she is passing the buck to the legislature, and we've been at a standstill with her for so long that we will take up the opportunity to work with the legislature, just as she has suggested. But it's still frustrating. And even though she has said that she will participate in efforts, and I hope and believe that she will, it's still frustrating that she continues to not act with her own power and is instead pushing this to somewhere else. She might have a firm held belief that this is something that should just be dealt with outside of her purview, but I think that's a really dangerous point to make for the rest of the state, basically to say that an attorney general just has to uphold racist or potentially even fascist laws, even if they know that they're wrong. And that's not that's a really dangerous position for the rest of the country to be in if other attorney generals held that position.
I also just want to
Please go ahead.
1 second to what Gregory just said. It's one of the things that I've come into lots of conversations with people about is, you know, is not just that some people believe or feel that this law is that this practice is wrong. This is it has been ruled by the Supreme Court of the United States that these convictions are. That these practices are unconstitutional, discriminatory, and rooted firmly in racism, anti-Semitism, and xenophobia. That is already decided. So this is no longer an issue of sort of people's, you know, feelings or impressions. And to not act on that, as Gregory is saying, is an active choice to continue to sort of support the legacy of discrimination, racism, anti-Semitism, and xenophobia that this law sort of put into effect, right? It isn't the choice to not act is a choice to continue that legacy, which we have already decided at the federal level is unconstitutional. So, you know, in my mind, there's sort of a full stop there. You know, this is no longer an issue of opinion. This is now an issue of a values-informed decision one way or the other. And we certainly hope that the attorney general chooses a values-informed decision to act.
And in your work, both you, Ben, and Gregory as well, in the work that you've been doing, you know, with the public and just, you know, our communities here, what are some misconceptions that you've noticed repeat themselves? And would you like to take a moment to dispel some of the ones that you've heard repeated often?
Gregory, Ben, do you want to take that?
Okay, sure. I can.
Go ahead.
Okay, there are a couple that, I mean, I think Gregory's already mentioned a couple. One misconception is, you know, this idea that all of a sudden, you know, the halls of justice are going to be overwhelmed with cases. I think it's super important to also say that Oregon, unlike Louisiana, never kept records of what were and were not unanimous or non-unanimous juries. So that's a thing, right? At first, in order for someone to even be able to come forward and under a claim of retroactivity, you know, they first have to be able to prove that they were convicted under a non-unanimous jury, which in Oregon is quite difficult. And secondly, you know, we've already said this, but I think it bears saying again that denying retroactivity out of a fear that the system will struggle to manage the cases, again, is an active choice to privilege the interests of the judicial system over those of the people whose rights the system is supposed to protect. So even if, you know, that is a misconception, things will be overwhelmed, but even if they were to be overwhelmed, choosing to elevate the interests of the system over the interests of the people who are affected by unconstitutional discriminatory practices is simply unacceptable. I think that's probably the biggest misconception that I'm hearing in my conversations with people.
Mm-hmm. And Gregory, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, just I think also that people think that we are just saying everybody should instantly be free. And that's not the call to action or the ask right now. So people have said, well, we think these people are still guilty. Well, if you think they're still guilty, then you can try them and see if they're guilty with a trial untainted by this specific form of racism, and then we'll find out. So that is one of the main ones I've heard And I think I do think that at the root of a lot of people's opposition to this is they think even if the system was racist, that these people are mostly guilty, and it's just really missing the point.
Definitely kind of perpetuating the whole racism and anti-Semitism to be, you know, that started all this. And so before we wrap up, I was wondering if you could give listeners a little bit of information, websites, whether it's social media, how they can get in touch with the coalition or help or learn more about the upcoming events.
Yeah, absolutely. You can go to stillinprison.org, which is where everything basically lives. We can always use more people joining the coalition. So if you're a group that wants to join the coalition or you just want to get in contact with us, everything is there at stillinprison.org. And also, if you want to know more about the Jewish community letter, we also have a link that's stillinprison.org/Jewish-community-letter.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And we will have all of that info to the Still in Prison camp, Still in Prison Coalition on our show notes at kbo.fm/thegap. And before we finish off, I just wanted to ask if you have anything else you'd like to leave our listeners with.
I want to quickly say, because this will astonish a lot of people, Terrence Hayes will be speaking at that event. Many people know that last name, Hayes. He is a relative of Quanice Hayes, who was murdered by the Portland police. And the judge in his case was actually the current Attorney General, Rosenblum. So it really just highlights how racism in our community and the criminal injustice system could just decimate a family. Losing somebody at 15 years old and also losing Terrence in the prime of his life because of a non-unanimous jury conviction, I think that will be astonishing to some people.
Definitely. That's another one of the just unbelievable. And hearing that would be like hearing that story and how in the work that they're doing now is just it's really unbelievable the strength that some people have. It blows my mind. And we'll, again, have all of that info up on the show notes. And thank you again so much, Gregory McElvey, an organizer with the Still in Prison campaign. And we also had Ben Anderson Nathy, who is a member of the Jewish community here in Portland, supporting the Still in Prison campaign coalition. And they have a event on August 12th. It's a bit of a teach-in to speak more about the coalition, what they do, and and hear how they can help, how you, the listener, the community member, can help and apply pressure to get justice restored here in our judicial system. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us and all the work that you do in general. It is not easy at all. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you. And we will be going on a very quick, short musical break, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes. Stay tuned in to The Gap here on KBO Portland. That was John Fahey with Sligo River Blues. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Tammy. This is The Gap. On the line with me is Althea. Hello, Althea. How are you doing?
What a great interview we just had. I'm excited to go to their website and learn even more. But we are in the second half of the show now. Fans of The Gap know that means it's time for our community question. So what are we talking about today? What do we want to hear from our listeners about? So in obviously the Tokyo Olympics are happening right now, and that has impacted their COVID cases there. And there's a spike happening. And so in reaction to that, the Japanese government has started to, quote unquote, name and shame people who break quarantine rules. And this week, or it was either this week or the week prior, three nationals were named by the health ministry. It was on Monday, for breaking the two-week quarantine that folks are required to self-impose after they travel abroad. So what we're asking folks today, and we'd love to have you call in, is what do you think about that strategy? Have you ever been shamed into quote-unquote good behavior? Give us a call, 503-231-8187.
Yes, the shame and the name and shame. We were talking when we went beforehand, we were trying to figure out, you know, about the subject, and the whole idea, the notion of shaming for good or shaming for bad, or what is bullying and what is quote unquote to humble people. And then we really unpacked what it means to quote unquote humble someone, and who has historically been told to humble themselves, it's mostly women and people of color. But this notion of changing someone's behavior and again, this is the general notion behind it, changing your behavior for the greater good because there is a national health crisis. The naming and shaming, I mean, they had their names and pictures up on the news, and that's pretty, that's no nonsense, straight to the chase type of thing. Just made me wonder about, A, is this effective? B, have people ever actually changed their behaviors because they were shamed into it? And I don't know, because I can see that either working or either creating some serious, like, animosity or something between folks. So, I would love to hear what people have to say about this, if this is something that, in their opinion, has worked for them in their experience, or maybe they've done it and it seemed that it worked. But at what price? Because I feel like you have to pay a steep price if you're still going to start shaming and naming. And again, the phone number is 503-231-8187. And like Althea said, this is this came about after we learned that the Japanese government is doing naming and shaming to people who are breaking quarantine rules because of the spike of COVID numbers following the Olympics and all the people there in Tokyo. Yes, Sonia, do you have something mm-hmm. you want to add?
Yeah, I think in considering this, it's important to distinguish, like, are we talking about a one-time thing and shaming something for someone for something that they had done, or is it versus a an ongoing behavior that you're trying to get them to change?
Well, I think
I think that's a good thing to know. And from the research that I did, it was like they ended up naming the three people in particular was because they were like actively like evading authorities. So in that case, is it just like, you know, Tokyo's most wanted COVID criminals? I don't know.
Now, one of the very, very few things that I kind of know and think I understand about the culture of Japan is that honor, about personal and family honor, is being really important, I think. And so that maybe like that's informing how people in a particular culture that values honor, and where shame is has a long history of a form of informal social control.
Yeah, I think there's
I know that Oh, go ahead, Tammy.
I was going to say, there's definitely something to be said about the way that we communities and cultures react to shame, or what they use it for. So yeah, that's also a really good point, because we were thinking, like, could this happen other places, or is this happening other places, you know? And I don't want to assume or anything, but from what I saw, it's not happening other places. And I was just wondering, is this, could this work? And I don't know if this would be go down as smoothly in the States. I don't know. I'm not saying like we should try or anything, but I don't know if you know, there's that same, if shame has been used in that aspect. Because again, when I think of shaming, I think of, like, you know, shaming, you know, like women and mm-hmm. folks of color, and not necessarily it being something that's in any way showing like an honor or something. But you know, that's just my point of view. Althea, I did cut you off if you wanted to keep on going.
Oh, I was just going to mention that some of the explanation very early in COVID last year about why countries like Japan were able to get, that they had really intense spikes of COVID very early on, but were able to get on top of it, was because, unlike the United States, that there was a greater sense of like responsibility to the collective versus the sort of rugged individualism that has had the United States on what, our fourth or fifth wave. And what role does the individual play, you know, in comparing those two kind of like cultural contexts, I think is interesting. But I in thinking about your question, Tammy, of like, would that work in the States, it feels like the way that things are right now, it feels like it would turn somebody into a martyr, you know. I mean, it can kind of go either way on social media, depending on, you know, what the politics of your your sort of social media bubble is, as to whether or not you're, you know, are you harassing the Walmart employee, or is the Walmart employee harassing you for not wearing a mask, you know? Which side of that do you land on?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've seen those videos. I guess, yeah, what is it? I mean, I guess the difference is it's not the government, you know, posting videos of people having a difficult time and shouting at, you know, employees at box, you know, big box stores. So I think what if the government was to do, it would be different than us doing it as, I guess, you know, community members and just kind of trying to call it out. But again, we'd love to hear from the listeners and your opinion around this. 503-231-8187. This is I like that you mentioned that they would probably be given like martyr status at this point, but I don't see it going down so easily here in the States. That's
yeah.
Honest truth.
Well, I think there's also like not necessarily, like, for most people there's not a high level of trust in the government. So like, I think that also plays into it, that the government was like, "Hey, you punk, stay in your house," you know. Like, I don't know that it would definitely be like, yeah, the government's right to do that, in terms of our general attitudes. But I think it's interesting to like think about it in a broader context in terms of like being shamed into good behavior, quote unquote, like whatever that means. And I can think of like a lot of small instances where, like, you know, a moment of embarrassment or somebody like calling you out in a sense, like, had a behavioral change. Like, for me, sometimes I talk kind of loud. I've been in, like, you know, a public setting and like been talking too loud and people got annoyed at me, or that I can sometimes like steamroll people, and like, I don't know, I don't like to do that either. But it's like, it's not really until you get checked and sort of like feel that, and you know, it depends on the person how long you feel it for. It's like, oh shoot, like I hurt my friend's feelings because I was kind of like steamrolling them and like in my own little world about how things are, and that wasn't cool. So like taking the step back, growing from it, but not like holding the shame long term, I think is maybe a thing to parse there. But yeah, if listeners want to chime in on this, either about the name and shame policy in Tokyo, or just generally thinking about shame and good behavior, give us a call, 503-231-8187.
Sodia, do you have anything you want to add? See you over there.
Well, you made a point, like, I think what we have, especially in a social media milieu, where we get that, like, those parasocial relationships that mm-hmm. seem to have different rules than, you know, face-to-face stuff. Trying to call attention, like, doing the whole, like, naming, like, this person here we see is acting against the interests of, you know, public health.
Mm-hmm.
As a way to kind of push them into better behavior, easily spirals in unhealthy and unhelpful ways because of the nature of the parasocial relationship, you know, because you're not actually sharing space with a person. We all end up acting in ways that we wouldn't.
Right, yeah.
Face to face. And so this kind of distorts the entire dynamic.
Mm.
Or is its own dynamic that is significantly different from what we've always had for, you know, until this past, you know, generation or so worth of, you know, couple of decades. And it continues to change and shift in ways that in-person interactions don't. Or it is starting to infect our in-person interactions as well. And so that's a factor.
Yeah. I think, and you know, you said, like, relationships, and when, again, the government is putting out your name and your a picture of you, like, that power balance is completely off. You know, it's not there is no balance there.
Mm-hmm.
And Althea, you said like COVID, you know, they're evading officials and they're like COVID's most wanted, and that kind of startled me a little bit, because it's like, oh, that could totally become a thing, you know, if people decide to not do what they do, then it could. Yeah, I mean, is this? I'm interested to see how this plays out, and like a lot of other things that we talk on the show, it's like, it's kind of, what are we gonna do? Like, what are people doing to people, and how we are trying to, I don't know, navigate this terrain that we've. I mean, we didn't. The coronavirus is something that we didn't ask for it. We didn't. I mean, you know, some people can say we did create it, but it's not something that was like of our. And again, some people can refute it, of our making. You know, so it's something that was kind of like we were tossed into, and we're all just trying. We're all just being ourselves within this really, just confusing, strange, scary times. And I don't know. I wonder how much of it is acting out, how much of it is people just being, you know, saying, I'm sick of this. And also in the specific instance that we're talking about with the name and shame in Tokyo, it was folks that were kind of, I want to say they were in their 20s or something, and they were coming back from holiday. So it's, in my mind, like, kind of makes sense. It's just like, you know, some youths being, you know, being rebels without a cause type thing. And I guess, is shaming the right way to go about it? I really don't know. Has that ever helped someone change their behaviors? I think so. Is it the right way to go? I don't know, again. But we'd love to hear, for the last few minutes, your opinion around this at 503-231-8187. And the first thing that comes to mind about the shame and name and, like, changing people's behaviors from causing them discomfort is the dog experiment, which I don't want to get into because it breaks my heart. But it's like, I don't know, I feel like it causes some sort of underlining animosity to the person who is creating the shame, you know? And so I wonder if we'll find ways to address that, because if it will fester, and how do we go about it so that it doesn't become something, you know, toxic, like we've been seeing a lot of really toxic behavior from being thrown to this situation that we didn't ask for, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I think that, like, it kind of factors into, I mean, we're not out of the woods, obviously, but, like, having reflections about how effective has, you know, different governments' response to COVID been, and how could it, you know, in the event that there's another pandemic or some other kind of global crisis like this, like, you know, the whole incentivizing behavior, how do you create both a carrot and a stick for people? And, you know, this is one attempt at a stick, obviously, the name and shame, which has actually been, you know, they made good on their word to do that. I guess it kind of remains to be seen what the actual impact that would have on somebody's life is, you know, because I think that, like, I don't know, really large scale shaming is probably, like, not the way to go if we're talking about democratic governments and whatnot. Not to say that we've always done that, but.
Right.
I think it's really interesting.
Yeah. And we do have a caller on the line. Francesca, thank you for calling. How are you doing? And what would you like to comment?
Hi. Well, it's kind of related about the name and shame, but, you know, I think with the big abortion case coming up in the Supreme Court in October, might be a good opportunity for people to, you know, with these anti-vaxxers and maskers and lunatics being like, my body, my choice. Well, I think the people that support, you know, a women's right to abortion and their own body and everything could get in their faces and be like, hey, we're on the same page with this. Because I don't know if you guys have seen, like, the, I'm sure you have, the don't tread on me in the shape of a uterus sign. Have you seen that?
Yeah, that's I get what you see. I've seen a couple of memes like that that are like, oh, look at us now, we're chanting the same thing. So it's
right.
An interesting.
So I don't know. I thought of that, and just the, or at least that would bring awareness to the hypocrisy of these crazies. And you know, just I was thinking of that last minute. So we're out of time, but love your show. Thank you, and
thank you for calling. Really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you, okay. Francesca. I do want to kind of move away from conflating mental illness with holding repugnant opinions. Like, whatever opinion you think is repugnant, I would encourage folks not to conflate mental illness with that. But Francesca's point otherwise is well taken, is the main gap between these two, as it were, between these two things, I shouldn't have to wear a mask, I shouldn't have to get a vaccine, my body, my choice, is that pregnancy is not transmitted by respiratory droplets in the air, nor is abortion. So you can't really make that same argument but on those two things.
I think it was more of a joke, but yes, I get what you mean. I think it was more of just like trying to see the bigger picture of the rights that you hold over your own body, and that it shouldn't be governed by someone else, which I think is just like the greater scheme that would like combine those two school of thoughts together. But yes, thank you so much, Francesca. I appreciate it. Althea, we have about 2 minutes left here for the show. And before we wrap up, I was wondering if you have anything that you'd like to add or any kind of upcoming things that you'd like to mention.
Oh, I wanted to, thank everybody for listening. I wanted to make a quick plug. We didn't have a mailbag segment today, but the offer still stands. If you'd like to email us, you can do that to thegapradio@gmail.com. You can message us on Instagram @thegapradio, or send us a letter, care of KBOO to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. We've been getting some mail, and we've been, you know, featuring it on the show. So if you have thoughts after the fact that you want to share, or, you know, anything, we'd be glad to receive it.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And like we mentioned beforehand, Democracy Now! Will be playing at 4 p.m. later today. It's been great talking with everyone and getting to hear about the Still in Prison campaign, which we will have this information up on our show notes at kboo.fm/thegap, so you can find out more on how to support this incredible effort, as well as get more information about the event happening on August 12th to bring more awareness and attention to the unjust, non-unanimous jury verdicts that people are still in jail for now. So it was really a really appreciate Ben and Gregory coming on the show to speak with us on it. And yeah, we'll be back next week, same time, new subject. Hopefully we'll both be in station.
We will be.
We will be, yes. Hopefully. We never know. But yes, I hope that you have a great rest of your weekend, and take care of yourselves and each other, because like it or not, we are all that we have. So thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you, Althea. Thank you, Sonia. And yes, that's it. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, everyone. Have a good weekend.
This is Norman Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements.